I'm Kevin Kelly. The show's Live and Local. It's your connection to local music and more. And we have a real treat for you today. It is certainly going to be a treat for me. Violinist Rachel Barton Pine is with us in the studio. She is the soloist for the Illinois Symphony Orchestra concerts this weekend. They're calling it their Valentine Surprise Concert. She is not the surprise. She is going to be playing a wonderful work by Eric Korngold, his violin concerto, twice this weekend. Tonight in Bloomington at the Bloomington Center for the Performing Arts, and then tomorrow night at Sangamon Auditorium at the University of Illinois Springfield with the Illinois Symphony conducted by Karen Lynn Deal. And she'll be playing a number of works for solo violin in our studio live today on Live and Local. You're listening to Live and Local on FM 90.9. I'm Kevin Kelly, and I am very pleased to have in our studio today a rather special guest, Rachel Barton Pine, who is a wonderful and incredibly versatile violinist. I've heard some recordings of hers of a rather wide range of music, and I've heard clips of an even wider range of music and going as far as heavy metal, which is pretty unusual for a classical person, and she's here today in advance of her performances in Bloomington and Springfield this weekend with the Illinois Symphony Orchestra tonight at the Bloomington Center for the Performing Arts. That concert starts at 8 o'clock, and on Saturday at the Sangamon Auditorium at the University of Illinois Springfield, that also starts at 8 o'clock, and as they're calling it, a Valentine surprise program, and we'll talk about that a little bit later, but she's playing one of my favorite concertos, which we'll also talk about later. Thanks very much for swinging by on your way to Springfield.
Great to be here. There's nothing like driving through the cornfields of Illinois to get you in the mood to play the Korngold violin concerto.
Very corny thing to say.
Exactly.
Well, it's a good thing we're doing this today instead of 2 days ago, because you wouldn't have made it, probably. You wouldn't even have made the trip.
We might have tried, but the weather gods weren't exactly kind.
Well, they've worked for us today.
And 2 days before that, I was on a sunny beach in Israel performing with the Israel Chamber Orchestra. So it was a little bit of a rude awakening to come back to the Midwest in sub-zero temperatures.
Yeah, no kidding. What did you do in Israel?
The Mendelssohn Concerto, Brahms Sextet, and an unaccompanied recital.
Wow. It's a good thing you just did an unaccompanied recital, because you are, in fact, unaccompanied today, except by your husband. But he doesn't play anything, does he? Or does he?
The radio, things like that.
The computer. Yeah. Tell me a little bit just about how you got started playing the violin.
Well, when I was 3 years old, I saw some middle school age girls playing violin in my church. And they had on the most beautiful long dresses. And I was just really intrigued by the sound of the instrument. I asked my mom if I could have some violin lessons, but she didn't take me really seriously. I think she thought I was more enamored of the clothes than the music, which of course wasn't true. But luckily, that summer in my neighborhood, there was a teacher just a few blocks down the street, and a lot of the kids that lived near to us were taking lessons, and their parents encouraged my parents to let me give it a try, and I fell in love with it right away. And by the time I was 5 years old, I really decided that not that I was someone who played the violin, but that I really was a violinist. That was what I was meant to do with my life, and I've been doing it ever since.
You said three was when you encountered this, at age three. Yeah. You really remember formulating that specific a notion at the age of five, that this is what I'm going to do?
Well, I actually started signing my kindergarten papers, Rachel, Violinist. And my parents were like, boy, this kid is strange. I was kind of like the opposite of the kid that you have to yell at to go practice. My parents were like, don't you want to put that thing down and go ride your bike or something?
Well, you did a lot better than I did, because in second grade, I used to run around and call myself Dr. Kelly, Mad Scientist. And it's a good thing that never happened. So
there's still time.
Some people might wonder in any event. And what kind of playing? You started exclusively classical?
Yes, I began with the Suzuki method, like many other little kids, learning to play the instrument before I learned to read the sheet music. And then a couple of years later, of course, I did learn to read music and graduated, you know, to the concerto repertoire and so on. And was very happy playing classical and touring around and doing competitions and starting to make recordings and all of that, until the magic moment when I was 20 years old and I got invited to play the national anthem for the Chicago Bulls for a playoff game.
Wow.
So that, of course, was a real thrill. I got to meet Michael Jordan and Scottie Pippen and got all their autographs. And it was really an amazing turning point in terms of my understanding of how classical music could reach people, because not only the 25,000 people in the stadium, but millions more watching on television that night saw this little violin performance that I gave for 2 minutes. And of course, I had invented my own sort of Paganini-esque version of the national anthem to try to showcase what the violin could do. And I guess people really responded to it. I started to get total strangers walking up to me on the street saying, "Hey, I saw you play for the Bulls, and I never realized that violins were so cool." And it made me realize that a lot of times when people think they know what classical is, it's only because they've maybe heard one end of the spectrum, maybe a little Pachelbel's canon in a dentist's waiting room or a hotel lobby or some soaring strings on a movie soundtrack. But they might not have heard the exciting end of the spectrum, you know, Mahler symphonies and Brahms violin concertos and Shostakovich string quartets. And that stuff is like, you know, if you had only heard Celine Dion and thought that was rock music, well, it's pretty, but it's kind of sleepy, and you never heard AC/DC or Metallica or Slayer. And so I started looking for ways to bring the violin to people who hadn't really had a chance to give it a try before. And that's when I started going on rock radio stations and playing a little Led Zeppelin or Metallica, followed up by a little Paganini or Schubert's Erl König or something like that, and starting to introduce my fellow rock fans to the excitement of classical music. And it's been really wonderful to have people come to their first ever classical concert and really fall in love with it.
Did you have an interest in rock and the usual kid things simultaneous with you doing the violin?
Yeah, well, you know, when I was 10 years old or so, and I got my first transistor radio, I started scrolling up and down the dial to see what else was out there and checking out the classic rock station and checking out the top 40 pop stations and just seeing what all that other music was all about out there on the airwaves. And I always found myself most drawn to hard rock and heavy metal. And that's really remained my taste through the years. There are a lot of kinds of music that I enjoy. Being a Chicagoan, growing up with the blues, of course, that has a special place in my heart. And any kind of folk music or traditional music, especially stuff with a fiddle, is always really fun. And there's a lot of great music. I guess the best way to put it is that my listening tastes are perhaps really no different than anyone else my age, except that I also enjoy classical. And therefore, it's entirely possible to like both. You don't have to only like classical or only like non-classical, but you can enjoy the full spectrum of what's out there. And, you know, the more good music, the better.
Have you done the Star Spangled Banner again for any other games? Was that a one-off?
Well, I did it for another playoff game the next year, and then, of course, they stopped being in the playoffs, but we won't talk about that. I did it for the inauguration of interleague play at the Cubs, when the Cubs played the Brewers back in, whenever that was. I did it for the inaugural home opener for the MLS Chicago Fire. So that was a great honor. Of course, it was really cold out there. It was so cold my hands wouldn't even vibrate. So in order to not sound like the music was dead without the benefit of vibrato, I had to sort of split up all the slurs. So it was almost like I was sawing away on my poor cold violin. But it was fun to be out there. I don't think I could ever do a football game, because any colder than that soccer game, and I wouldn't have been able to move my fingers at all.
Well, you can just do what Yo-Yo Ma and Itzhak Perlman did at President Obama's inauguration.
That's true.
Finger sync it.
Exactly. But yeah, where else have... Oh, I played for the Democratic National Convention when that was in Chicago a couple of elections ago. So that was pretty cool.
Were these all the Star Spangled Banner? You did other things as well.
Well, I mean, you were asking about Star Spangled Banner.
Yeah, right, sure.
Performances. So those are the ones that come to mind. But actually, what I'm really, really excited about is that after all these years of, you know, taking my little national anthem version around and some of my other compositions and arrangements and cadenzas and so forth, and everybody keeps asking, you know, well, where can I get the sheet music? Well, just as of a couple months ago, I'm so pleased that Carl Fisher has published the Rachel Barton Pine Collection.
I was reading that in your
all
bio.
All of the stuff that I've written, and it's in the same series as the Kreisler and Heifetz Collection. So that's a really great honor, and it's really exciting that, you know, anybody that wants to play the stuff I've written can now go and get the collection and, you know, give it a whirl themselves.
How would you feel about a little Star Spangled Banner right now?
Oh, man, it's been a while since I practiced it, I have to admit.
That's what I was sort of leading up to.
But I could play something else from the collection.
By all means.
This is my very most recent arrangement. It's one of the most popular Spanish guitar pieces by Albéniz called Asturias. Oh. I'm sure you'll recognize it. It's just one of those tunes that's just in the air. Everybody knows it. And it was actually originally a solo piano version, but it's most known in its solo guitar version. And now I've made it into a solo violin version.
And I'm curious to make sure that I have the right tune in mind, which you're going to resolve for me in just a moment.
All right.
Rachel Barton Pine is live with us here on Live and Local on FM 90.9.
Thank you.
That was certainly fun to listen to, and it looked like it was probably fun to play. You said it was part of the newest creation for your collection, Rachel Barton Pine collection, that people can buy. But I'm thinking, if you want to buy that, you better have some chops to be able to play it. You didn't make that easy.
Well, you know, sometimes I'm like, gosh, why did I write that? That's really a finger twister. But I always write what I think is going to sound good. And then if it happens to need a lot of practice time at the back end, well, that's just an unfortunate side effect of what I was going for.
And then you just have to practice it. Yeah, you're in control there. Rachel Barton Pine performing music by Isaac Albéniz, his Asturias. And it was the piece I was remembering. I'm not very good at naming that tune. WFMT radio station in your hometown of Chicago. When I was living there, used to play that. It seemed every time they had an extra space.
Exactly.
They would
so
throw that in
now
there.
I'm hoping that they will occasionally play the violin version because yeah. I recorded it, and that album's going to be released later this year. It's going to be called Capricho Latino, and it's an album of unaccompanied violin music by Spanish and Latin American composers.
So this is this becoming a specialty of yours on the unaccompanied violin? Because I know we have one that's mostly, is it all Baroque? Certainly some Baroque.
Solo Baroque.
The Devil. The Devil's Trill is on there, I think.
That the Instrument of the Devil is my album of Halloween-y pieces,
there
Round
we go,
of the Goblin,
right.
And Devil's Trill and Witch's Dance. And
you mentioned Errol Koenig. Is that on there?
Yes, yeah. Yes, it is. Mephisto Waltz in Milstein's version for violin. Most of that stuff has piano accompaniment. But, you know, I do end up doing a certain number of unaccompanied performances just as I go around and visit schools or do outreach types of things or charitable events. So I definitely have built up my unaccompanied repertoire and haven't made too many albums. I think actually this will be only my second solo or, you know, violin alone type album, but I'd collected these wonderful, spicy Latino pieces over the years, and it was just a project waiting to happen, so I'm very excited about it.
Yeah, it sounds like a lot of fun. And they're all your arrangements, or mostly your arrangements?
Nope, just that one. The rest are stuff by other guys, like Rodrigo's Capriccio and Ricci's arrangement of Recuerdos a la Alhambra. My performances of Spanish music are better inflected than my pronunciations, let's put it that way.
Memories of the Alhambra, that's the way I'd go, just do it in English.
Yeah, and tangos by Piazzolla and a wonderful living composer from Colorado named Luis Jorge Gonzalez, and Jose Cerebrier from Uruguay wrote another tango for me. And yeah, so there are a couple pieces actually written for me, which is pretty
fun. Yeah, that's terrific.
And then other stuff I've dug up and collected over the years.
You know you've made it when people start writing stuff for you. I think that's one measure potentially of, you know, because somebody has admired your playing sufficiently that they want to make something for you to of their own for you to carry around to the world.
Very exciting because, in learning repertoire, especially historic repertoire from the 20th, 19th, 18th, et cetera, centuries going on back, one of the things that I really enjoy learning about is not only the composer and the composer's style and what was going on in the composer's life at the time that they were writing it and the performance practices of the day, et cetera, but very often an important component is the dedicatee. When you think about the Brahms Concerto being written for Joachim and how strong an influence Joachim's playing and Joachim's approach to musical aesthetics was on Brahms's creation, or Sarasate and his knowledge of Scottish folk music playing a large part in the Celtic flavor of Brooke's Scottish Fantasy, which, despite Brooke being German, really isn't German at all. That kind of thing is always so fun to learn about the relationship between the creator and the inspiration, the performer. And so it's been just such an amazing honor to be part of those collaborations myself and to see, as these compositions are being put together, you know, what of my playing or my personality is melding with the personality and compositional style of the composer, and kind of, you know, that this piece is perhaps, you know, while the composers are being true to their own voice, I think they're, when they write something for a particular violinist or a particular player, the piece is something different than it would be if they were writing for a different player. And seeing myself in there, it's like, whoa, that is really cool. And it just, you know, fits me so well. And it's just such an extra pleasure to play those pieces that have been written with me in mind.
I would think people would have an interesting challenge writing for you something that would fit, because you're so multifaceted. I mean, you actually brought with you your Baroque bow, because you do some period instrument performances, solo and in your trio. How do you say the name of your trio?
Settecento.
And what does that mean?
It's an Italian word that literally means, it's what they use to refer to the 1700s. You know, English is very confusing because the 1700s are the 18th century and stuff like that. But, you know, they're more literal in other languages. So Settecento just means 1700s, which, of course, is where much of the Baroque repertoire comes from, at least the high Baroque. Of course, Trio Settecento goes all the way on back through the music of the 1600s and all of the wonderful early Baroque repertoire. But Trio Settecento just sounded like a nice, it kind of rolls off the tongue, so we named ourselves that.
A lot easier than Recuerdos of the whatever.
Exactly.
Trio Settecento. And, of course, we're going to get in a little bit to your other, the other extension of your range, which is into the heavy metal music and other kinds of rock music. But, of course, you're here in our studio right now en route to Springfield and Bloomington, where you're going to be playing one of the most romantic of all the romantic, and in this case post-romantic, violin concertos by Eric Wolfgang Korngold with the Illinois Symphony, Friday night, tonight, in Bloomington at the Bloomington Center for the Performing Arts, and then Saturday night at the University of Illinois Springfield at the Sangamon Auditorium there. And we're really glad you could swing by here. When you're making your own compositions or arrangements or cadenzas, I noticed that you write some of your own cadenzas for what about your own technique do you try to keep in mind? Do you try to exploit certain of your own strengths? Do you try to stretch yourself beyond what you might think you can do?
Well, definitely, I do write things that lie well in my hand. There are certain things that come very naturally to me, like the particular bow bouncing technique of Paganini's Caprice No. 5, three downs and an up. For some reason, when I pick up the bow, I can just do it. Other things I have to really sweat for, like up bow staccato, which some people can just pick up the bow and have a great machine gun staccato, and for me, I have to really work at it. So, you know, everybody has different strengths, and, you know, sure enough, in many of my arrangements, I will throw in some bouncing bow stuff just because I can, and it sounds cool, and for me, it's easy. I'm not going to be as likely to do as much with up bow staccato because that's not my strength. I'll put in a little where it needs to be musically, but I won't overindulge in that particular technique for sure. But when it comes to cadenzas, it's really a question of staying within the appropriate style of the composer. I'm going to put in, you know, some flashy pyrotechnics in a Paganini cadenza that I would never put in a Mozart cadenza because it just wouldn't be within the taste of the style of the period. And certainly harmonies in a cadenza to the Brahms concerto that I wouldn't put in those harmonies in the Beethoven concerto cadenza, etc. But it's really wonderful to write your own cadenza for concertos, and I highly recommend it because and honestly, you know, as exciting as it would be for me if somebody wanted to play one of my cadenzas, I think what would be even more exciting is if young violinists or colleagues were inspired to write their own cadenzas, because that's really the most organic way that you can reflect your interpretation of the concerto, which is, of course, unique to yourself. And, you know, there's nothing that's going to be, you know, more well melded with your interpretation than your own cadenza, which can flow right out of your interpretation and reflect your thoughts and feelings about the style of the concerto, your favorite parts of the concerto, etc. And in fact, if I were ever to significantly change my approach to any of these concertos for which I've already written cadenzas, I would probably have to write a new cadenza that would then blend with my new approach.
Well, the whole business of writing cadenzas is, except for a relatively few people, seems to be a lost art. But when back in the days when these pieces were written, people improvised the thing. You know, it was their own creation every time they did it. Like, you know, Beethoven's cadenzas for piano or the violin concerto, Mozart's.
Exactly. And I think it is a healthy development in string playing and string pedagogy that more and more players, you know, through efforts like Mark O'Connor's Fiddle Camps or some of the alternative styles workshops at the American String Teachers Association conventions, more and more people are starting to explore playing some of the traditional fiddle styles and doing more improv type stuff, whether it's jazz or playing in some kind of an indie rock band, or I don't know how many people are really doing heavy metal, but you know, just different ways to have creative outlets where you're making up stuff, and especially making up stuff on the spot. And I'm hoping that as the next generation comes up, that we do start to see more and more young violinists picking the ball back up and going back to the older traditions of creating some of their own recital repertoire and their own encores and their own cadenzas. Because I think, you know, certainly there's more than enough talent out there and more than enough fresh voices that could really do some interesting things. It's just that, you know, every decade that passes, more and more music has been written. And it's all we can do to just scratch the surface of what already exists. And we almost don't have time to add to it because we're so busy learning the pieces that have already been composed. And so I think it's just something that's not been dismissed, but more just kind of like forgotten because people are so busy. So I'm hoping that the publication of my collection will maybe, you know, plant a seed in that, hey, you know, it's not just the dead guys that do this, but maybe I can do it too.
Well, I can tell you there's at least one kid who's in fifth grade who is working on it, because a young fellow named Daniel Melling, who was in with his brother in this very studio, and they played some stuff, and he played his own cadenza to one of the Mozart concertos.
Fantastic.
Fifth grader, so
that's great.
At least one guy is working on it. So maybe we can connect you at some point, and he can be further inspired. Well, since you did bring along your Baroque bow, how would you feel about giving a little demonstration on it?
Absolutely. Well, since I don't have a viola da gamba and a harpsichord or the players of those instruments here with me. I'll have to go it alone, but my most recent CD, as you mentioned, is with my chamber group, Trio Settecento, John-Mark Rosendahl on bowed bass and David Schrader on keyboard, and you know they play organ or harpsichord or baroque cello or viola da gamba, whatever the repertoire needs, and of course I play baroque violin, and we just released our second album under our own name, which is a German bouquet, music from 17th and 18th century German composers, or as you might call it, Bach and his contemporaries and predecessors, because when it comes to the German Baroque, everything centers around Bach in the end. So I have, of course, my modernized 1742 Del Gesu, but with a Baroque bow on my modernized violin, it really does bring you awfully close to the tone color palette of the authentic equipment.
Before you launch into whatever it is you're about to play, since you have both bows here, we had a fellow here who kind of plays both, but he didn't have both his bows. Just for the sake of our audience who might not really know what's the difference between these things, particularly since we don't have a television camera.
Yeah, well, I will quickly describe it visually. The Baroque bow is a little bit shorter than the modern bow, and it's a completely different aerodynamic concept. Of course, string instrument bows were invented about 1,000 years ago from the idea of the bow and arrow, literally curved pieces of yew wood with horsehair knotted at either end, very primitive devices that were drawn across strings to create more sustained types of singing qualities. And then, of course, in the Baroque period, the design was made more sophisticated with a turning mechanism and a frog for you to hold your hand and so forth. But it still remained with the wood curved outwards, hearkening back to its roots. And with the modern bow made out of Pernambuco wood from Brazil, it's a revolutionary design where the wood curves inwards. So there's a completely different set of tone colors and articulations. Baroque bows are made out of ironwood or snake wood. Mine is made out of snake wood, and if you look closely, it actually looks like a mottled snake skin.
I can see that from here, actually.
In the grain of the wood. It's pretty funky. So actually, I'll do a little audio demonstration. This is the first few bars of the B minor bourré of Bach from his first partita. I'm going to do it first with the modern bow, and you'll see how it wants to have a very sharp attack. I'm just kind of doing what comes naturally to the bow if I play this passage. It's a very full-voiced, strong, and powerful type of sound. The Baroque bow wants to roll the chords a little more elegantly. Sweeter sound. Now you can actually, especially if you've had the opportunity to fool around, spend some time with a Baroque bow, you can try to imitate that sound with the modern bow. But I'm actually kind of fighting against the bow's very nature. I'm having to work really hard to do that. And if I do it with the Baroque bow, it just kind of does it all by itself. So I feel like using the more authentic equipment brings me closer to Bach's original intentions, but it also is more about just what the kind of sound that I like. There's certainly nothing wrong with playing modernized Bach if you do it well and convincingly and, you know, have conviction about that's the way you like to play it. I enjoy many performances of interpretations that I would never do myself. But for me, I really love the sound of a more historically informed type of approach. And the Baroque bow is just plain easier.
So is that the piece you were about to launch into before I interrupted?
Nope, that's just my demo passage. I thought I would play something a little more soulful. This is a piece I played for that recital in Israel a few days ago from the D minor partita, the second partita. It's the Sarah Bond movement, the third movement.
Thank you.
Wonderful music by Johann Sebastian Bach, played live in our studio on Live and Local by Rachel Barton Pine. Thank you very much for playing that. And I really love the sound of the difference of the Baroque bow.
Yeah, people don't realize how much the bow really contributes to the tone of a violin.
And especially if you know how to wield it. but as you said too, you know, if you just let it do what it does on its own, you've done half the work, I guess.
Yep.
At least compared to a modern one, if you're trying to make it do the same thing. Rachel is here in our studio in advance of her performances in Bloomington and Springfield tonight and tomorrow of a very, well, you know, not so different kind of piece, now that I think about it. The opening of the Korngold Concerto.
It's so evocative.
It's almost one of those
once upon a time type openings that just sets the mood right away. You know, people have said, well, Korngold's music sounds too much like Hollywood. But actually, that's all backwards. Hollywood sounds like Korngold because we were lucky enough that when Korngold came over to the U.S., he started writing movie soundtracks. But
exactly.
He was a child prodigy. He was one of the great sort of late romantic or post-romantic composers following in the tradition of Strauss and Mahler and... You know, I mean, it's just great music. And in fact, he didn't take movie themes and recycle them into a violin concerto. The concerto was written first, and he used some of those melodies in soundtracks for four different films. And then finally, the concerto was revived, or not revived, but rescued from obscurity and started to be performed many years after it had first been written. And so it's an interesting journey that the concerto had. But definitely watching the movies is informative because you can kind of see from the scenes that he chose to use this music for. It tells you something about the mood that he had in mind for these particular melodies or passages. But, you know, this is not movie music. This is Korngold music. And
yeah.
He's one of the great late German composers. So it's an absolutely gorgeous piece and very grateful for the violin. You know, it's...
What do you mean by that?
Well, one of the more challenging technically, it's definitely not an easy concerto. It's got all kinds of, you know, very virtuosic passages, but it also just feels good to play. It's very, you know, you have a lot of rubatos and you have a lot of room to have expressive slides, and it just feels like something written for the violin, as opposed to some of the great concertos, Brahms and Beethoven, for example, which are concertos that are written for the violin, but it's pure music that just happens to be played on the violin and not necessarily perfectly idiomatic for that instrument, even though you can't imagine them playing, you know, being played by anything other than the voice of the violin, but it's not very violinistic. But Korngold is a violinist's violin concerto, which is so interesting because, I mean, he wasn't exactly a violinist himself, but yet he obviously understood so well violin playing that he could write something that sounds like something a violinist might even write for themselves.
Do you know offhand, was he a pianist?
I believe so.
Because I was thinking the two you mentioned, Beethoven and Brahms, were both pianists, and that, you know, that created problems for their performers of other music.
Exactly. Gosh, how many of passages of Brahms' chamber music, you're like, wait a sec, dude, this is a keyboard type of a figuration, and now I have to make all those string crosses? That's
yeah.
Just insane.
I was just kind of struck, too, just listening to the Bach earlier, and as soon as I said Korngold, I'm thinking some of those, almost as though some of those same gestures that you had just played show up in Korngold. And then when you were talking about it just now, I was thinking some of the, you know, the freedom for rubato that is inherently in the Bach solo
yes.
stuff. I heard you when you were warming up before we started the program doing some of the Korngold.
Yeah,
did you want to...
I can give you a little taste here.
It's just a gorgeous, gorgeous piece of music.
So this is music from a film called Another Dawn.
Thank you.
orchestra kicks over with a soaring melody.
And that is a solo violin opening, right?
No, isn't the orchestra is playing from underneath? The get-go.
But it almost feels like it.
It's definitely a soloistic moment. And if you listen to those soundtracks, it's almost sometimes like the orchestra or, in many cases, the concertmaster playing solo violin bits within the soundtrack orchestration is almost like an additional character in the film because it's so present. It's not like background music, but it really is setting the mood and the scene so vividly. And what's really also so cool about many of those old movies and soundtracks is that just like Korngold was one of the best composers coming out of Europe of that generation, and yet he chose to write for films because that was where the best income was to be found, many people who could have made careers as concertmasters of symphony orchestras or even as violin soloists chose to move to Hollywood and play in studio orchestras because, again, you know, that was where they could really make a lot of money. And so you hear our students, you know, the same guy that taught Heifetz and Milstein and Oistrakh, guys like Eddie Brown, you know, playing on these soundtracks. And it's just absolutely world-class soloist quality violin playing in these concertmaster moments, in these old black and white movies.
Did you feel it was part of your job in preparing the Korngold Concerto to see the movies?
Exactly. It was the only violin concerto where I ever got to have a blockbuster night, and it was part of my research.
Yeah.
Especially the last movement, because it's got that wonderful da-dum, bum, bum, da-dum, bum, bum.
Oh, that's right. That's
you know, from The Prince and the Pauper. So it's just like high-spirited young adolescent boys, you know, clowning around and, you know, that wonderful youthful energy. And when you see the movie and, you know, the sort of triumphant moment when the whole orchestra comes in as he's parading down the street and all of that, it really helps you to capture that feeling of just joyfulness that Korngold is obviously evoking with his last movement.
You know, The Prince and the Pauper, I think that was a record that when I was a kid, we had, it was like the voice tracks from it, but I've never seen the movie. So I really have to go out and do that sometime.
It's fun. It's worth seeing, even if you aren't researching the violin concerto.
Well, as long as we're talking about the violin concerto, let me put in a pitch for the reason you're able to come through here today. We are visiting with Rachel Barton Pine and hearing her live in our studio. She's going to be performing the concerto by Eric Korngold with the Illinois Symphony twice this weekend, tonight at 8 o'clock. I'm just forgetting the time all of a sudden. I think it's at 8 o'clock at the Bloomington Center for the Performing Arts. Yes, 8 o'clock. And then tomorrow night at 8 o'clock at Sangamon Auditorium, the University of Illinois Springfield.
And let me put in an additional plug, which is that 1 hour in advance of each of those performances, there is a pre-concert conversation with myself and Maestra Karen Deal, where you can hear us discuss the repertoire and take some audience questions and fun stuff like that. So it's really worth showing up early and get a chance to meet the artists before we launch into the performance.
Yeah, exactly. I've forgotten that they do those things. And by the way, anybody who is from the Champaign-Urbana area and has heard the Champaign-Urbana Symphony over the years, it's worth mentioning that the former conductor of the CU Symphony, Paul Vermeil, is making a guest appearance on this program. And there is also a Valentine surprise. One of the pieces has been quite strategically unnamed. It is supposed to be a surprise love story from a mystery composer, I'm quoting here, which promises to enchant sweethearts of all ages during these concerts right before Valentine's Day. You're listening to Live and Local on FM 90.9. I'm Kevin Kelly. So I mentioned a few times in this conversation that you play heavy metal music, and not only that, you're in a heavy metal band.
Yes.
It was a wonderful name, Earthen Grave.
Well, what I love about it is that grave, of course, when you're talking about classical music, Italian words, grave, means, you know, slow and somber and serious. And the style of heavy metal, because, of course, heavy metal is an umbrella term for a number of subgenres, we play a mixture of thrash metal, which is sometimes called speed metal, which is very fast and virtuosic, and mixed with doom metal, which is a very slow, ponderous, Very dark and serious type of heavy metal, kind of building on what Black Sabbath started, that sort of style. And of course, grave is exactly describing doom metal. So it all works out somehow.
And I'll bet you've brought us some samples of some kind or another.
Well, I have a little teeny tiny piece that's an example of some thrash metal. It's actually a classical piece that was composed for me by a friend of mine, the concertmaster of the concertmaster of the Jacksonville Symphony in Florida. I was trying to remember which Florida orchestra of it. Philip Pan, a wonderful violinist. And it's a question of, okay, what's crossover and what's classical? And as far as I'm concerned, this is classical music, just like a Brahms Hungarian dance or, any of those things inspired by other styles are classical music. It's through composed, and it just happens to use this particular type of heavy metal as its building block. And heck, why not? Classical's drawn upon everything else through the years, from jazz back to waltzes. So this is called simply Thrash, and it's by, like I said, Philip Pan, and just a little taste of the acoustic violin imitating things like distortion and whammy bars and shredder riffs.
So is that a piece that's meant to be played? It's just for solo violin? Or is
yep.
it you're not backed up with a band?
Oh, no. That's for unaccompanied violin.
Wow, that's very cool. That's a great piece. That's a great piece. So when you're with the band, you actually told me in advance that you dress differently. You put on different kind of makeup. and who else? Is it just standard metal rock instrumentation in the band?
Yeah. Well, actually, it's sort of a typical type of configuration: two guitars, bass, vocals, and drums. The only difference is that there's also a six-string electric violin.
Oh, six-string. Wow.
And it's a really interesting instrument because it's actually head-free, which is great for metal because you can headbang. Which is not just for the look of headbanging, but it's music that you really do need to move to really create the right type of feel and impact. And so it straps onto the body. It looks like a miniature flying V guitar. And of course, with the six strings, it's an extended range. It has all the notes of the acoustic violin and then more than one octave lower with a C string like a viola and then an F string getting into the cello range. So it's really not a violin at all, but more like a cousin of the violin and plugged into a Marshall amp. And it's really fun to get to jam along with the guitars and trade solos and improvise and play all those great riffs.
Have you had anybody yet write something for that instrument for you?
I've had a couple people offer, but I feel like if somebody's going to write something, I want it to be for the real violin because that's where I'm going out and doing all of my recitals and things like that. But the day might come. We'll see.
It may well come. And you already take your regular violin into rock clubs and other sort of non-traditional classical venues to try to open up the audience for classical music.
Exactly. Well, I've always wanted to be a missionary for classical music and introduce the beauty of the violin to as many people as I possibly could. I'm not out here to be a missionary for metal. If people like metal and want to check it out, that's great. But what's funny is that some of my classical friends and other people have actually come to hear my band just out of sheer curiosity, and a lot of them have ended up liking it. I've even had friends who've never been to any rock concert at all, ever, of any style of rock music, who've come to hear my band, and I've been like, oh no, this is a little hardcore for your very first rock concert. But, you know, if it's good music, it's good music. And just, you know, put in your earplugs, and there are good melodies and good harmonies, and, you know, it's fun stuff.
Yeah, well, as you said, music's music. What was it? Wasn't that Ellington's phrase that he turned that into? It's either good or it's not.
Exactly.
You know, one way or another. Well, you have the enthusiasm that I'd like to borrow sometime when trying to recruit for the youth orchestra around here, you know, to get some kids who otherwise seem a bit somnambulistic about classical music, and if we had more folks with that energy.
I think we had an email communication about a youth orchestra here in town, and I'm going to try to figure out a date to come back to the area and visit them before the end of the year.
Well, if any of our players are listening, that's something to look forward to. Rachel Barton Pine, our guest here on Live and Local, right in our studio, and she's going to be in Bloomington and Springfield this weekend. Tonight in Bloomington, 8 o'clock at the Bloomington Center for the Performing Arts. Saturday in Springfield at the Sangamon Auditorium at the University of Illinois, Springfield, with the Illinois Symphony Orchestra, Karen Deal, conducting a Valentine's program with a Valentine surprise, and the incredibly romantic and gorgeous and challenging Eric Korngold Concerto for Violin with this wonderful player who, you know, one of the, just before I say goodbye, I have to say I loved that your sound changed totally with whatever it was you were playing. You know, I was going to ask you about the instrument that you have seems to have the capacity to change with the music.
Yeah, well, it's an amazing instrument. Of course, interpretationally, it's always a question of, you know, you want to be true to the composer, but you also want to be true to yourself. You don't want to be completely taking yourself out of the picture. So it's really finding that balance between having it, you know, personal to your own voice while also, you know, not going against the composer's intentions. But having a violin like this makes it all that much more fun. This instrument was made in the year 1742 by Guarneri del Gesu. Of course, Guarneris and Stradivaris are considered to be the two greatest kinds of violins that exist, and many players have preferred Guarneris, like Isaac Stern, Yasha Heifetz, Paganini, Izai, Kreisler, and I've always preferred the Guarneri sound. Maybe it's because I'm a heavy metal fan. Guarneris tend to be deeper and darker, very powerful, very rich on the lower end of the range, though they can certainly be sweet when they need to. This particular instrument is known as the Ex-Soldat, in honor of Marie Soldat, one of the rare 19th century women violin soloists. She was a protege of Brahms, one of the first champions of his concerto and a frequent chamber music collaborator. And Brahms actually found an aristocratic family to buy this instrument for her use, or to agree to buy an instrument that she would play, and then Brahms himself picked this one.
No kidding.
So it's amazing. I just wish it could tell me about meeting Brahms, or more importantly, the fact that Marie Soldat played this violin and played chamber music with Brahms. It means that my violin got to jam with Brahms.
That's incredible. That's incredible.
It's pretty awesome.
And you got to jam on it right here in our studio. I really appreciate your coming in, and it's been a pleasure to spend the time
with you. Thanks so much for having me.
It's Live and Local on FM 90.9, Rachel Barton Pine.